This is The Takeaway with MHP. From WNYC and PRX in collaboration with GBH News in Boston.
Half of Americans will die in hospice care. And that end-of-life care is essential to many families. Some of you told us how it supported you through tough times.
I have experience with hospice care with both my parents. When they were going through the death process, they were professional, caring, helpful. They listened very well, and I always felt like they would be right there when we needed them.
And we heard from some of you about the comfort and support for those who have exhausted all treatment options and are preparing for a final transition.
Hi, my name is Scott, and I have been a hospice nurse now for 6 years, and actually in the last 2 years, I have been specializing in making extra visits to patients that we think are in the last 7 days. I feel honored to be able to help families and patients go through this process.
But what began as a way to help people die with dignity has become a $22 billion industry plagued by exploitation. And some of you told us about that, too.
I do have experience with hospice care, and it was horrific. They lied to my dad about the kind of care he was going to get. He signed the paperwork. They told him that they're not going to kill him. And essentially, over the next few days, they drugged him up with so much Benadryl, it shut down his organs. They wouldn't even give him water. I wish we never went through this process with this company, and I would do anything to change it. It robbed my children and my partner of having the last few quality days with my dad, and I regret all of it.
As always, we're so grateful to all of you who shared powerful and sometimes painful hospice stories with us. And to learn more about the contemporary realities of hospice care, I sat down with Ava Kaufman. She's a reporter at ProPublica and author of How Hospice Became a For-Profit Hustle. It's a recent collaboration with The New Yorker. What is it that makes hospice care so lucrative?
So what I found in my reporting is that hospices are actually incentivized by how the Medicare benefit works to chase after, go after patients who may or may not be actually eligible for hospice. And so what we found and saw through over 100 lawsuits over the last two decades is that hospices are actually, you know, hustling or chasing after these patients. And the way that hospice works is that it's quite a bespoke program. So you might just have a nurse coming by, even in the best of circumstances, twice a week for 30 minutes each. Most of the care is still provided by the family. You're still going to be the one who is helping administer the medications, who's helping with toilet aid. That actually saves hospices a lot of money, that most of the care is outsourced to family members. Overhead as well is quite low, given the fact that most care takes place in home. So hospices aren't building out facilities in the same way one would for a skilled nursing facility or a hospital. And the last thing that kind of makes hospice quite lucrative for people who are in it to seek profits is that even though to sign up for hospice, you have to have 6 months or less to live, there's nothing that stops hospice from recertifying you as eligible time and time again. So there are patients who stay on hospice for quite a long time. And those patients, if they're stable, if they aren't requiring extra medications or higher levels of care, can end up being a revenue stream of sorts.
Right. Because if you're dealing with truly end-of-life care, truly end-of-life, it could be days, weeks, maybe months, but your client will be passing on and away and out of your business.
You know, part of the reason that hospice, you know, is sometimes being used for people who have longer than 6 months to live is we have such a lack of long-term care and elder care services in this country. And so if you're someone with an unpredictable decline, like dementia, studies have found that hospice might be all there is in terms of even just having someone come by to check on you, someone come by to help out your family member. And then, of course, the flip side of that, Melissa, is that there's also people being signed up who might not be anywhere near chronically ill or disabled or in this kind of gray zone who are actually losing access to treatments that they really need because they think they're signing up just for home health care. And those stories were particularly horrifying to come across.
Is it the same providers that are sometimes behaving in one way and other times behaving in another way? Or are these actually different providers that are behaving differently in the system?
So 7 out of 10 of the largest providers of hospice care, actually both for-profit and nonprofit, have been accused by employees of enrolling ineligible patients, signing up people who weren't appropriate, chasing after them, and even pressuring their employees with bonuses and quotas to do so. And what I found in my reporting was that since 2000, far more than just the largest hospice companies have been accused of such fraudulent practices, often by their own employees. These are tactics that we are seeing at some of the biggest hospice companies. Often they end up settling with the government and admitting no wrongdoing, you know, brokering settlements to kind of, in some cases, you know, cover the cost of the money they've been accused of stealing from Medicare. But it's both small and large players that seem to kind of be incentivized by how the benefit is designed to engage in these practices.
What does it take to become a hospice provider? How do you get into the system?
Basically, anyone can open up a hospice. If you and I decided to get into the hospice business, we would be more than welcome to. It would start with getting a state survey. Someone would come by and check that we had posted our hours of operation on the door before we'd opened, that we had some sort of small office, and that we had the right number of staff hired. And after that, most surveys are actually outsourced to private accreditation agencies. And that is only happening once every 3 years. And so one of the things I was really shocked by when researching the wild, wild west of hospice ownership is that there are people who own 20, 25 hospices all clustered within blocks of each other and are just transferring patients from hospice to hospice after they hit a kind of Medicare billing limit. There are people who own hospices who have criminal backgrounds. There are people who get into hospices after being accountants or real estate agents. It's an incredibly, quote unquote, hot area for private equity. And I think all of that just shows you how much money under the current system there is to be made in hospice right now, which sounds like a ridiculous thing to say.
You and I are probably both pretty smart folks. I'd trust us to do all kinds of things. But if I am needing end-of-life care for my loved one, how do I make sure that it's not the two of us who end up at my home?
There are some things that you can try to do. And I should say that, you know, it's unfortunate that it has to be on the kind of, you know, quote unquote, consumer or client. But one of the biggest things is looking to see, you know, who owns the hospice, how long have they, you know, set it up for. You know, that is something that with, you know, a little Googling, anyone can find out. The other thing is there is a government kind of database called Hospice Compare, and they're starting to collect some quality of care metrics that allow you to see, you know, how many of their patients did they check for pain. There's a kind of nascent star rating system that's rolled out for some of the hospices. I would check to see, you know, what's the hospice's for-profit or nonprofit status? Do they have a higher level of complaints because of their, you know, for-profit status? Are they owned by a private equity group? What's the private equity group's history in the healthcare sector? You know, does this seem like a long-term investment or something that's being squeezed for profits and flipped? Can the hospice confirm that they're going to provide, you know, the right kind of equipment? I guess doing that homework and doing that research to make sure that, you know, you and your family are steered to a provider who's there to provide, you know, the essential hospice mission.
All right, let's take a quick pause. We'll be right back with Ava Kaufman on the for-profit hospice hustle. It's The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're still with us on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're back with Ava Kaufman of ProPublica, talking about her recent reporting on the U.S. hospice industry. Now, I asked Ava why there's no organization that regulates hospice care in the U.S.
CMS, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, do have more data available than they currently make public. And some of that data, if contextualized the right way, I think would help families immediately see some of the problems with hospices. They could use that to regulate hospices so that hospices with these really concerning and unusual patterns of care are being given an extra look or even, when appropriate, weeded out of the system altogether.
What has made it so difficult to actually provide this kind of oversight, again, given that this is a government-based program?
One of the really tricky things about hospice is that it's taking place at home. It's a lot harder to regulate things that are out of sight, happening behind closed doors. The other just really insurmountable structural obstacle is the fact that you're supposed to die, and family members as well are often too grieved or stressed. All that said, there's obviously, you know, more that can and should be done, perhaps surveying hospices more frequently, using data, as I mentioned, to go after providers with egregious or suspicious metrics of quality of care. And the last thing, Melissa, is, you know, perhaps you and I shouldn't be able to just open a hospice if this whole journalism thing doesn't work out. And so a greater attention to licensing so that we're not getting these hospice mills.
Can you tell us about the Marbles?
Patricia Marble was in her 70s when she began receiving hospice care from a provider in the area. And she had many health troubles, and she accepted the doctor's diagnosis. But over time, she began to get incredibly confused and feel worse than she ever had before she had entered hospice. And as the years went on, she continued to receive, you know, incredibly high doses of narcotic medications. And they were affecting her ability to move around. She barely knew kind of who or where she was. And at one point said that she just felt like, you know, she was already dead. And it wasn't until she was essentially unresponsive one morning and taken to the hospital by her husband and daughter, and the doctors took one look at her and said, how was this woman on hospice for the last 5 years and being given such high doses of narcotic medications? And once she was taken out of hospice, she was weaned off the drugs through an intensive kind of rehab program. Her memory improved, her breathing improved, and her family began to see that time that they had lost together and that time that she had lost with her grandchildren as a sort of nightmare. It was a sort of kind of Rip Van Winkle story. And then Patricia later said, you know, she felt like the lights had been turned back on. And so for people who may originally be eligible for hospice, but then, you know, may turn out to not be appropriate, it's really important for families to ask those questions if their doctors are continuing, you know, to certify them an incredibly, you know, questionable amount of time. And this was a company that had, you know, bonuses and incentives for bringing in hospice admissions.
Just stunning. Ava Kaufman, thank you so much for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Ava Kaufman is a reporter at ProPublica.